Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Bunker Books podcast. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Chris Clark, who is the author of a book. Anyone who is trying to understand what has gone on the British left, I think, ought to read, called The Dark Knight and the Puppet Master. It's an account, I think the best way to describe it, Chris, of distortions in left-wing thinking and how they work against ever getting a left-wing government in Britain. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. It's the book is, I guess, it's a polemic criticising left-wing populism, as I call it, and specifically criticising some of the myths and narratives which I think prevent truly progressive politics from succeeding, and which often tend to dominate thinking on the left.
Before we go any further, I can imagine some of our listeners wrinkling their nose and harumphing at the very notion of left-wing populism exists, because Jeremy Corbyn didn't look like Donald Trump or Viktor Orban. Why would you say what's happened in Britain is populism comparable to what's happened in America, Hungary, Venezuela?
Well, I wouldn't say it's as extreme as those sorts of populisms, clearly. I'm certainly not saying that Corbyn was a kind of Chavez, and nor would I say that Boris Johnson's necessarily a Viktor Orban. What I'm looking at in the book is that the narratives which underline populism, and I look specifically at three narratives in the book. The first is the myth of the other, the second is the myth of the all-powerful puppet master, and the third is the kind of nostalgia. And according to that definition of populism, which is what I set out in the book, I very much would say that Corbynism fed into and fed from those kind of populist ideas. So, I very much think that left populism can take a left-wing form just as much as a right-wing form if it buys into those narratives.
How did you come to write it? How did you come to be so involved in the Labour Party?
Well, I've done various sort of jobbing kind of Labour Party jobs, mainly being acting as a press officer for Labour politicians or prospective politicians, and have been a kind of door knocker and leafletter at elections and things like that. But I guess I wrote the book from the perspective of a person who is intensely frustrated, a kind of ordinary Labour member and supporter, I suppose, who was intensely frustrated with the direction of travel, particularly after 2015. I'd worked as a press officer in South Thanet, Nigel Farage's target seat for Labour in the 2015 election. And I came back and I was just, you know, really concerned by the shift that seems to be taking place and by the rise of Corbynism. And the book emerged because I think at that point in 2015, and actually all the way through as it continued, the question of where the centre-left and the far-left really disagreed was one that no one could quite put their finger on. It was kind of like nailing jelly to a wall. And you'd have conversations with people who, in terms of their core principles, in terms of the kind of ideal society they'd like to see, were no more or less progressive than you, but were, you know, really enthused by Corbyn, and you were absolutely kind of horrified by the prospect of a Corbyn Labour leadership. So my kind of central hypothesis that brought the book about was that the difference really lay somewhere else. It wasn't about just degrees of radicalism, that one person wanted a top rate of tax that was sort of
60% wrong, 50% or whatever.
Yeah. It was about much more than the substance of the difference between these two wings of politics. It was about these narratives and the places I would find real disagreement with the, you know, Corbynite left friends of mine, or, you know, when you were watching debates between Corbyn supporters and non-Corbyn supporters on social media or on Question Time or wherever it might be, it was frequently at the level of narrative.
Let's give people some idea of those narratives. Let's go through them all first. The Dark Knight, that is seeing your opponents as just evil.
Yeah, it's so each of these myths, they can be stronger or weaker, but the Dark Knight is the idea that essentially that the political spectrum is a moral spectrum and that the left is at the good end of that spectrum. So it sees the world in terms of good versus bad, good versus evil in some cases, and it sees that political spectrum as entirely morally charged. So the further away from the left you are on that spectrum, the more kind of self-serving, careerist, immoral you are, and the less you kind of care about society or care about other people. So it sees politics in those terms. It's the politics of the kind of Tories are lower than vermin, to use a much quoted example. Ultimately, it sees politics as taking the form of being entirely based on conflict as a result of that. It's a kind of righteous conflict. And its precedent is set in the kind of the politics and the mindset of class war, of Cold War, more recently of culture war. It creates a whole set of bogeymen who are villainous to their core, and that, you know, as a person on the left, you must almost define your political identity as being on the right side of these good versus bad oppositions. So that's the first one.
We've got the Dark Knight. We've got the idea that we, people on the left, are up against implacably evil forces. And then the suggestion that because we are up against evil and greed and rotten people, any tactic can be justified. Can you explain the idea that of the puppet master and how that influences thinking?
Yeah, the puppet master, I think the puppet master and the Dark Knight conflate and overlap quite a lot. But ultimately, the puppet master is a qualitatively different idea. It's the idea that the ills of society are ultimately authored. They are inflicted on us from above for the most part. And it essentially takes on the thinking and mentality of the idea that we kind of live in a you know, something close to a dictatorship rather than a broadly functioning democracy. So it would be the notion of the mainstream media, the MSM, who are supposedly kind of manipulating and doing propaganda for the government. It would be ideas about the deep state. It's in many respects it's the kind of thin end of the conspiracy theorist's wedge.
Finally, the golden age. Golden Age on the right is quite hard to say. Is it 1950s Britain or is it 1850s Britain? Is the Golden Age Palmerston Empire or suburban nuclear families, very little divorce, no abortion, no visible homosexuality? Your Golden Age on the left is kind of a Ken Loach version of the 1940s. That's their lost world.
Yes, completely. As you say, like all three of these myths, I think, have an almost direct read across to the right. And I suppose part of the reason I focused on the left was, firstly, as someone on the left, you start with your own kind of backyard, I suppose. And secondly, I think one key important difference to draw between right these myths when they take a right populist form and when they take a left populist form is that generally right wing populism beats left wing populism most of the time. The right wing version of this is more electorally effective. Right-wing puppet masters or Dark Knights make easier hornet's nests to kick, for want of a better analogy. The left-wing simply cannot provide as easy answers, is not as good at providing easy answers as the right-wing and doing that. So it's not the correct strategy, quite aside from the rights and wrongs of it, in my view. The golden era, to explain that, it's the idea of a sort of moment of original socialism that modern society has departed from, and it's the idea we're moving into a kind of reactionary dystopia, which is that's a society that has kind of lost all sense of what's right, sense of what's real, and is kind of moving towards being a kind of neoliberal chrome future. So it's an extremely sentimental recollection of the years after the Second World War and the post-war consensus, combined with the idea of neoliberalism being the is almost the coronary artery of this myth. And it's used not just as an economic term, neoliberalism, and it's a very broad economic term, but it's also used to, you know, foreign wars, consumerism, climate change, all of these things are grouped into this tanker that's moving in the opposite direction. I think for the left, yes, it is the sort of post-war 1945 era that is imagined, but I think it goes deeper than this in a certain way. I think even in the 1950s, people were sort of saying that the 1945 to 51 Labour governments weren't fit to lace the boots of their forefathers. So I think it's a sense of some original purpose, a sense of the kind of this giant mission, unbelievable in its ambition, that everything now feels so watered down and the real world can never quite match up. So it's a deeper myopia than just a nostalgia for three or four decades.
Chris, I'm so old, I remember the 1983 election when Thatcher won by a landslide, and she won, sorry, I haven't got the figures in front of me, but she won majority of trade unionist votes. So this is 1983, this is Thatcher, the great figure of evil, and the years before the miners' strike, which is kind of, you know, the culloden of the labour movement, trade unionists are voting for Margaret Thatcher in very, very large numbers, and working class voters were, because she seemed to have a better offer and a better way of running the country. So the idea that somehow it was just because Peter Mandelson and Tony Blair arrived in sharp suits that betrayed all of it is full of birds. As you say, all your intellectual faults are ways of stopping people thinking. You can't draw plans for the future. You can't really understand the past either.
The myths, ultimately, they get in the way of true and more accurate explanations. For example, why would someone from a working class background vote Conservative? And the Dark Knight myth gets in the way of really thinking about that, trying to understand it, trying to understand how, you know, different values, different life experiences. It allows an easy, you know, so blame self-interest, blame lack of whatever it might be.
Well, people are either wicked or they're stupid and allow themselves to be manipulated by wicked thought controllers, which is not a great way to get their votes, really, is it?
Yeah, I think these myths, in a way, a lot of the sort of discussions I've had about the book have focused explicitly on Corbynism, but I think in a more latent sense, these myths have been quite a big way ingrained in thinking.
That's why I was disagreeing with you earlier when you said, oh, well, this is just, the worst is just the far left. The far left is like the centre left, only more so in its faults. It just exaggerates them. It's not really a communist movement anymore. Often it just exaggerates the vices that are prevalent everywhere in the liberal mainstream and the centre left. And you can't make, which I've heard a lot of lay politicians say, oh, well, Nick, you know, it's just a few nutters. It's not us. But often, as you're saying, with nostalgia, with fake nostalgia, as fake as anything Nigel Farage offers, you can find that everywhere. It's not just a certain group of people who fall for that.
I completely agree with you about that. But I think the hard left that you're talking about, I do think if you look at what happened in 2015, Corbyn came in, and for people who, in my view, could see where, what he was and where he came from that absolute hard left tradition, which was took lots of very unsavoury positions. But if you look at how that reached a much wider audience, I think these myths played quite a central role. For example, the idea of the glorious past of brass bands, in a quite harmless way initially, those myths are the thing that makes that palatable and makes that link between somebody who's friends with Stalinists and all of this stuff, that makes the link between that and kind of just a young idealistic student who wants a better world. And I think that the myths, in a way, they represent threads that drag people off into, in my view, the wrong course. And I think Corbyn was fundamentally the wrong course. But so in a way, yeah, I'm kind of agreeing with you that they provide a link into essentially the extremism of the far left and extreme ways of thinking for a perfectly decent, well-meaning person. If you don't think that if you don't have the Tories are lower than vermin mug on your shelf, and you don't actually think that, you think that the right are profoundly wrong, but you don't think they're bad people, then it's much more difficult for you to, get lost and follow in the way that, in my view, the Corbynite left have done, or the followers of Corbyn have done in the last 6 years.
Okay, Chris. Now there's some big questions for you. Is the left or the Labour Party just fucked in Britain, do you think? I mean, left-wing, you look at the Social Democrats in Germany, the Socialist Party in France. You know, it's not just about Corbyn, Blair, all of that. You look across Europe, and we are a European country, despite what the government says, they're pretty screwed. Do you think that the way society's moved, and through all the faults of its own thinking that you've addressed, that Labour is just screwed in Britain now?
I certainly don't think that Labour is screwed in Britain by any stretch. And in a certain respect, you mentioned earlier society becoming significantly more socially liberal. And the big realignment taking place is in large part the result of younger people being more socially liberal and in many ways more egalitarian. And so I think in a certain respect, I know that you can never say, you know, the demographics, just follow the demographics, but I think the overall changes taking place in attitudes reflect a move towards a more progressive society in many ways. The problem is, for some reason, the left, I would say, through its reliance on these myths and through its populist ways of thinking, doesn't seem to be able to bring the rest of the country along with it. So instead you have a culture war, which is somehow progressives are losing, despite the fact that the country as a whole is more sort of progressive in many cases than it was 20 years, 30 years ago or something. It requires really clever thinking to get out of this and the electoral arithmetic of how the country's based, and populism just really won't cut it, basically.
I think Johnson's making a big strategic mistake by getting too deep into culture war, actually. He has benefited. Yes, we are becoming more liberal, but there are discontents and contradictions. So I first saw it with left-wing Muslims and ex-Muslims, who suddenly found on the left you weren't allowed to criticise really theocratic, right-wing, fascistic Islamist ideas because that somehow was playing into the hands of George W. Bush. And so the Conservatives just had to sort of sit back a bit, but now they're becoming active and very stupid participants. I don't think Johnson knows what he's doing though. I think it plays well in the Tory press, but I think there's a clever Labour Party can start painting them as intolerant and ignorant and unpleasant again.
Completely. And I think that in a certain respect, the Tories are sort of creating their own obsolescence in a strange respect, because if you look at the kind of the data on all these blue wall seats, which will, I think, ultimately begin to shift towards Labour over a longer time scale, I think in a longer term sense, conditions are relatively good for progressives. But in a shorter term sense, there is very easy wins for the Tories through continuing to inflame this culture war and continuing to rack up those votes in parts of the seats away from London.
But doesn't that, in the long run, if you see that kind, doesn't that rely on Labour having a leader who's a bit like Angela Merkel rather than, I mean, someone who's, you know, economically really quite small C conservative, does some intervention, but, you know, while being socially very liberal, rather than a red-blooded Labour leader?
I think it relies on two things. You know, these two things are almost so far away now that you might say it's not worth discussing. But I think the way that Labour can change the country without dividing the country, if you like, is firstly to be really strongly internationalist and serious about internationalism, multinationalist approaches, in all the substance of things, to be looking at ways that you can work at a kind of supranational level to deal with, you know, corporation tax, to deal with global wealth inequality, to deal with climate change, all of these issues which require joined up, coherent approaches. But to be given the license to do that, the Labour or progressives need to be trusted that just because we're being very internationalist and multilateral in our approaches, that doesn't mean the UK being changed beyond recognition. So it requires a simultaneous kind of cultural reassurance. And I don't think that cultural reassurance means being sort of kind of tub-thumpingly wrapped in the Union Jack, but it requires showing people that you're serious, that you're sensible. And in a way, the real tragedy of Corbynism was that he was in precisely the wrong place. So at a kind of, in terms of internationally, he was actually extremely parochial, you know, a lifelong sort of, quotes, Lexiteer, right up until it became very difficult for him to make the Lexit arguments in 2016, opposed to foreign intervention of any kind, really quite an insular politics in terms of the substance, but culturally very kind of anti-patriotic. And I think that the ultimate answer for Labour will be about saying, how can we work to reduce inequality, reduce regional inequality, whatever it is, with other nations, because that's the level at which change now needs to take place. How can we tackle those things, tackle climate change, whilst providing the reassurance in the opposite direction. But I appreciate that right now we seem quite a long way away from that, with the UK leaving the
not least because I'll have to start talking about the EU again.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So,
which they don't want to do.
Yeah, so in a basic sense, I don't think Labour's completely screwed, but I do think that right now it is exceptionally hard, and it's going to need to perform some kind of electoral judo throw to start winning back types of voters that have, not just from 2015, but really for a time beyond that, been moving, swinging towards the Conservatives.
Well, there you go, Chris. Thank you so much for all your time and for all your trouble. Your final message seems to be it's going to be long, hard and miserable for as far as anyone can see, but there may just be a glimmer of hope sometime in the early 2030s, which is by far and away the most positive message that the Bunker podcast has broadcast in years. Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Bunker. If you've liked the show, please go on to your podcast dispensing site and post a good review. If you didn't, you can please keep your opinions to yourselves. There's a Patreon where you can give us a bit of money, which we desperately need to keep all these programmes going. My name's Nick Cohen. Thank you very much.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Nick Cohen. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.